Hi everybody, welcome along. Tuesday morning, a little cold, but we've got some heaters on, a little warmer. And for those of you online, thank you for attending the class. Okay, so we're up to class 8 on All About Karma. We'll begin as we normally do by saying a few prayers together, correcting our motivation. And then during the class, there'll be periods for questions and also for meditation. So the first thing to do is for you guys to all get comfortable in your seat. So try to make sure that your feet are flat on the floor or on a cushion. You want to have your sort of back straight and shoulders relaxed. And if you can, try not to slump because the breath will not get down into your belly. So you want to sort of lift yourself up, but at the same time be relaxed. Now you can place your hands wherever you like. And you can close your eyes or keep them partially open, whatever suits you. Then just let your body breathe itself. And as the body continues to breathe itself, feel into the movements the body makes. And then just relax into that awareness. Then imagine the nature of the floor that your feet are upon is made of starry sapphire light. It's as light and as soft as a cloud. And the space above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. And in the space in front of you appears a throne with cushions of lotus, sun, and moon. And sitting on the moon seat is the Buddha, Shakyamuni. And he is surrounded by an assembly of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, deities, and other enlightened beings. Meanwhile, are surrounded by all sentient beings. These include your parents, family members, close friends, difficult people, and strangers. So take a moment now to recollect how fortunate you are to still be alive. And while you are alive, you have the leisure and opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. You need to act quickly, though, because things are not quite right. This world does not exist as it seems to. The permanence and substantiality that the world appears to have, it actually lacks. Impermanence is everywhere, though nothing is lasting. Though this is the case, we have come to contact with a spiritual friend. And this friend of ours is leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. The Buddha as a teacher or doctor, the Dharma as the teachings or medicine, and the Sangha, the companions on our path, or like nurses who administer the teachings. We're going in the safe direction. We're making our lives meaningful. To make this practice of ours as purely as possible, I want you to imagine yourself as clear as a deity. Just as if your body is made of rainbow light and you hold a divine identity. And you're holding a Vajra and Bell, which symbolizes the empty nature of all phenomena and the skillful means that you apply to help others. And you're sitting within a sphere of great bliss. From within this sphere of great bliss, you are determined to help others overcome the causes of suffering and help them to fully flourish as enlightened beings. To accomplish this, you say, in the company of the Buddha and the spiritual community, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this aspiration of ours, this wish to become enlightened, imagine that from the heart of each enlightened being above you, lights and nectar stream down and dissolve into yourself and all living beings that surround you. Under this rainfall of light and nectar, negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan are increased, along with your virtues and realizations. So feeling cleansed by wisdom and love, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. The love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. They are immeasurable because they're extended to all sentient beings. So decide to develop these four immeasurable thoughts yourself and to establish all beings in the four immeasurable states. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So I've made another wish to develop the good qualities of the four immeasurable thoughts. In response to this wish of ours, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down and dissolve in yourself and all the living beings surrounding you. Under this rainfall of light and nectar, negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan are increased, along with your virtues and realizations of Dharma. And it's from this empowered state, you allow yourself to exhale and relax. And from that relaxed state of awareness, we invite the field for accumulated merit. And they appear. And in their company, we say, reverently I prostrate my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma from human beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So having accumulated some merit and purified our body, speech and mind somewhat, We want to prevent ourselves from clinging to the mirror as if it were inherently real or objectively existent. Just to prevent that, we imagine that our ordinary body, speech, and mind, our merit and enjoyments are utterly transformed into the enjoyments of the environment of a living Buddha. And we offer this pure land that we've created to the Buddha, the Lama, and the spiritual entourage. And we say, this ground, anointed with perfumes, strewn with flowers, the dawn of Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as the Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guratna Mandala Kamaratayam. So the Buddha accepts the offering with delight and smiles at us. And we look up and we meet his gaze. And from within the gaze of the Buddha, we recollect our wish to develop renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. And our aspiration to be fully awakened ourselves. So induced by our wishes and prayers, there emerges from the Buddha a second figure who absorbs into you. And your form clearly becomes that of a Guru Buddha. So radiating from a small seed towards your heart, life rays strike all sentient beings surrounding you and place them in the state of a Guru Buddha. So you and all sentient beings, each seen as the Buddha. Have at your heart a moon disc upon which is the white syllable A that's encircled by the mantra, by which we all begin to recite, saying, I think now the two purposes have been achieved. You've brought about your own enlightenment and you've brought about the enlightenment of all beings. So they recollect that this has been a meditation, which is primarily one of imagination. Through the process of imagination, we have imprinted the mind with the possibility of awakening for the benefit of others. To think that by this virtue that we've created, may each of us quickly achieve the state of a Guru Buddha and place all sentient beings without exception into that very state. I think that this is the purpose for our study of karma, refuge, and every other topic we study here. And now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, with your eyes flush open, and move your body in whichever way you'd like to so you feel quite happy. So what we'll do first, we'll briefly look over what we've covered already. Then I'll introduce you to today's topic, show you some of the books I've relied upon, and we'll engage in the study. So what we did last week, we looked at the four opponents. So can anybody remember what the most important of the four opponents is?
Regret.
It's a regret or remorse. This is the most important. And what's the second most important one of the four? Restraint, remedy.
Resolve.
Resolve. Right. Resolve is the thing that resolve is like a promise, I'm not going to ever do that again. You have to have this, it's a normal thing, because when you regret something, we often don't want to do what we've just regretted. So we go, I'm not going to do that again. We try to make this firm within ourselves, this resolve not to do the same activity again. Yes, I've got this remorse. There's the antidotes, the promise or the resolve, and then to be able to rely upon something so that you don't do it again. So those are the four opponents. We looked at throwing and completing karma. So what does the throwing karma do? Sue? I think that's right. Throws you into the rebirth, right? The throwing karma is a consequence of that throwing karma. We've all ended up as human beings. And the completing karma is what sort of fills in the picture. The fact that we've got the clothing, we've got the jobs, the houses, the families we meet, all that sort of stuff, it completes the picture. Now, karmas are basically, there are three mental karmas, three physical, and four verbal. There are many others, of course, but this is the place where you start from. So in other words, restrain the physical actions that create harm for yourself and others. Restrain the way you use your speech, that don't hurt yourself and others. And finally, restrain how you think, because the person is definitely going to be hurt by your thinking, isn't it? And so we want to avoid rough ways, unkind ways of thinking, because we are harmed by it. These actions that we create, whether it be body, speech, or mind, are made up of a number of different parts. And karma has principles. Now, the most important one that I'm trying to get through to you, which I hope I have done, is what is it? That karma is definite or certain, isn't it? Please tell me what you remember of this. What is definite or certain about karma? Sue's laughing, you tell me. That's right. And just like that, if you put that into your mind in a simple way like that, you'll get it, and then you'll know. Am I doing good? Because if I am, it produces a good effect. If it's not that way, you know you'll suffer a bad effect. This is the most important things, of course, to recollect. There are others that over time, the power of the action that you engage in, it increases. But it says that karma is magnified. You can never experience an action that you've not done. Just like I cannot win the lottery if I've not bought a ticket. It's just not going to happen. So if you really wish to be happy and you haven't traced the causes, it's not going to happen. If you suffer a great deal and you want to be rid of it and just wish to be rid of it, it's not going to happen unless you do something more than that. And what was the last one? So karma just doesn't vanish on its own. Well, once we've created a full action, there are consequences. Unless you do something. If you don't do anything, the consequences will take place. And karma is basically what? What's the most important thing? If you say, what is karma? It is?
Action.
Action. And what type of action is it? The action of?
Intention.
That's right. So this is the thing. So we have physical, verbal, and mental actions. They're called karmas. The most important thing is, what's the intention driving it? Because that's the karma.
Very good. Very good.
But today we're going to look at some of the different means of purification. So this sort of follows on from last week. We start with remorse, and then we need to do something. Right? Once we've done something that's hurting us, we're looking, what do I do? What do I do? We're going to look at a number of different things you can do. The six methods for purification. Deity practices for purification. So a little while ago, some of you might have been here, we were introduced to the practice of Vajrasattva. So Vajrasattva is a deity for purification. There are others too. I'll introduce you to two of those. And then how to create merit. Yeah, so we'll get to each of these. And so here are some books that I found very useful. So in terms of the purification, this is what we're looking at, these six methods. Up the top, there's a text for the Everlasting Rain of Nectar. That's a deity practice for the 35 Buddha practice. Anyone can do this practice. It's sutra practice. You don't need to have an initiation for it. Anyone can do it. Then we have the Four Noble Truths. So here is a great section in that book on karma. And karma, of course, is one of the causes for suffering. Negative karmas create suffering. Samsara, Nirvana, and Buddha nature gives us this huge, big picture of the whole thing. What is the this effect we call samsara? Nirvana is the ending of that effect. So it's no longer experienced. And why is that possible? Because we have Buddha nature. It's just because of the nature of the mind. The mind creates the problems, the mind has to solve them. Steps on the Path to Enlightenment is a large book. There's quite a few of them out there, at a very good price. It's a really comprehensive overall view of karma. So the books are usually around $80 to $90 nowadays, those books out there. So I think we'd be selling for like $30. If you find that's too much, make an offer and see what she says. She'll probably be quite okay with it. Buddhism down the bottom here, again, this is a summary of 8 other books, all like this, but it's got a very good presentation again on karma. Foundation of Buddhist practice, same again. And then here we have this Vajrasattva practice that I'll talk a little bit about today. It's another way of purifying the mind. Again, a deity practice. Often for this type of initiation is required, but not always. Finally, a book called Karma, What It Is and What It's Not. This is really good because it shows you the whole transformation of the concept of karma over time. So what it was like before the Buddha got a hold of it, and then how the Buddha changed the concepts of it, and then how it's practiced today. And Charlie Gripper showed a tremendous teacher, had degrees in Western psychology, taught in Melbourne for years. And I like his take on things, primarily psychological, not so much religious. Anyway, so I've called upon this material and I've read all these, they're very good. You know, if we talk about karma, like I say, karma is an action or an intention within the action. And these actions can be of a positive type or a negative type. Sometimes there's also what they call neutral activities. But we'll just put that aside. So here we're really concerned with positive actions and negative actions. And what are the positive intentions that drive them? So we have these things called, positive karma or negative karma. What's another term? Have you heard, Devin?
Constructive
actions and actions of destruction. So happiness is destroyed by different types of activities. And they're actually produced and depends upon other actions. So, and these, when we talk about positive karma, we're talking about virtue. And they ask, sometimes ask me, what's the major cause of happiness? And sometimes the answer is given as virtue. So what do you want? So what's virtue then? And there are a number of different types of virtuous ways of thinking and behaving. So we are encouraged to create virtue, positive karma, positive actions. Why? Because this is a major source for our own happiness. This happiness is also called a merit. The different terms used for it. Now, just as negative karmas can be destroyed, so we don't experience their effects. This is the whole way of presenting karma. Look, if we could do nothing about it, I should just be quiet, right? What's the point of talking about it? But because our unhappiness has causes, we can interrupt those causes and prevent our unhappiness. If we wish to be happy, we just need to know what causes it. Okay, then that's what I'll do. And we do it, right? And you check out, you'll get the effect. It's just cause and effect. So it's really about mental cause and effect. So just as our negative behaviors don't have to produce negative outcomes because we
we get in the way, we interfere with it, yeah? We don't just let it go on and ripen. We know, okay, if a seed of karma has been planted, it actually requires a lot of other conditions before it actually becomes a full-on flourishing of suffering, right? Just like a seed in a normal plant. Just because you've got a seed does not mean you've got a plant. You don't, do you? Seeds are plants, are not plants, right? Seeds of suffering are not suffering. They've got to meet conditions, and then you get the effect. So our job is don't put in place the conditions. The major condition for a karma to erupt is your thinking. It's disturbing emotions. You already have the cause for it there, hasn't met the conditions yet. The conditions are disturbing emotions. As soon as they come together, now it's on. So in terms of the suffering, we don't want that to happen. So we have to either destroy the conditions or destroy the cause. Either way will work. Interfere with the conditions, you won't get a full call, you won't get the full thing of the cause. We try and get in there, mess it up. But happiness also, we've got the seeds of happiness on our mental continuum too. You know, we've done a lot of good things. We are happy in this life. Often vanishes pretty quickly, of course, but we do have these moments of happiness. What do you think destroys that happiness? What's the major destroyer of our ordinary happiness? You hit it, that's right, it's anger. Yeah, so anger destroys, is a great destroyer of virtue. And anger is a mental affliction. Our mind becomes afflicted. It meets up what we've already created, and the good side, it wipes it out. You don't have access to it. So I know this from my own experience, and you might too. If you've ever been in a relationship with somebody and it's really good, right, for a long, long time, and then something happens and then you have anger towards that person, over time it's very difficult to remember anything good that they ever did, isn't it? It's as simple as that. Right? So what we've done is we've destroyed our own access to what was good. It takes quite a lot of work to rewind it too. But anger is the great destroyer of virtue. It's the single biggest destroyer of positive karma. So whatever you can do to have less anger, do it. You'll be a happier person. There are a number of opponents to anger. The most common one that they often teach is to be patient. So this is not just the suppressing of anger. It's patience. You have good reasons to be patient. So patience is built on a reasoning base. You want to find as many reasons as you can to be patient and find the one that resonates with you. Go, that's the one for me. So like I said, there's many of them. And fortify it, right? Come back again and again. One of the most common is this idea that we keep forgetting, at least I do, that we as sentient beings are suffering. You know, we forget that. So instead of seeing suffering people, we see people we should be angry at. Right? It's like, no, you've forgotten. But it's like, we're all sick. We're also addicted to our own ways of seeing things and our behaviors and everything. We're out of whack. Everyone's like that, just to greater or lesser degrees. And when you forget it, you become impatient and then you get angry. Right? You think things should be different. Well, they can't be different. We're all sick, right? We're all under the weather, so to speak. But like again, this requires you to remember that. And it's not an easy, you know, to remember it often means meditating on it, becoming familiar with it. And if we don't, we will forget. We will forget. So anger is the greatest destroyer of virtue. So we need to like purify right, these different mental states. So there are six methods for purification. And so I'll run them down the list and then we'll go through each one of the things you can do. So the first is to read or recite, or it's just more profound sutras, but like I said, I'll go into each of these individually. The second is wisdom realizing emptiness. This is the destroyer. This will take care of the karma and the disturbing emotions. Yeah, it was a river. It's not the major problem is that we over. There's a term called a reification. We have reified ourselves, our behaviors, and the world around us. The world doesn't exist in that way. You know, we don't exist in that way. But we've thought for a long time we did and do. We have to sort of unwrap it, unwind it, come back to the reality. Emptiness is what they call the reality. There's recitation, worship, images, and names. Now, when you read some of the books about the spiritual masters, you'll see that they've gone through all of these different activities to prevent themselves experiencing the suffering from past behaviors and to give themselves mental space to actually engage in something good. You know, so one of the analogies I often use to myself is like, you know, when we go, when we're at home and we're about to eat a meal, do you go and take out a clean plate and then put the fresh food on and eat? Or do you look for a dirty plate and then put the food on and eat from that? I'm sure most of us, I don't know anybody here that go, I need to find a dirty plate because I'm going to dirty it anyway, so I might as well eat it on that. Who knows who they are? We need a nice clean plate. So spiritual things are not like that. We've got a lot of gunk. We're messed up. Right? So we've got to clear a little bit of space. Then we can really develop the good qualities. And most of us don't do this. We just want to bring on the good straight away, right? Then we sort of our meals, we become polluted by what we've already got in place. So we try to create some space, and purification is about that. Letting go of some of the concepts that really hold us back, and then bringing new, fresh concepts that are based in reality and truthful and meaningful. So we'll go for the first one here. Oh, so these are, like I said, these six are like different medicines. So you see a lot of medical analogies and gardening analogies in the Buddhist text. So here's like to say, the Buddha is the doctor, the Dharma is the medicine, the nurses are the people who accompany the doctor to help you with the medicine. So these are all to be seen as like different types of medicines to help us overcome the poison that we've already ingested. Okay, so let's have a look at the first one, relying on the Profound Sutras. So there's a number of different ways you can do this. One is just to receive the sutra. So there's a number of different meanings. So one is that you actually get a sutra and it's given to you. But the other is like to mentally receive it by a teacher reciting it aloud. So sometimes we've had it here where they come in and they recite the whole thing really quickly in Tibetan. Right? And so it's like, all you have to do is listen. And now you've received the sutra. You don't have to understand or anything like that. That's enough. That's like saying just receiving it is an amazing thing. But then, of course, is reading them. There is retaining the meanings of them and then explaining them either to yourself or to somebody else and praising them. These are five different activities you can do in relationship to a sutra. So in terms of receiving them, so when my first wife passed away, we had a complete lamb rib all wrapped up and then we placed it on her head as she lay in the bed. Yeah? You can do the same with your pets. Right? You pick up your Dharma text and have them receive it just by placing it on their head. Yeah? So I can then bring about the purification. You can also like when I took the ashes of my wife and spread up the CI, and I was walking around doing the Heart Sutra, I was reciting it aloud. So you can do this sort of thing. Of course, if you can try and retain some of the meaning of it, that's even better. It helps you a great deal. And then, like I said, you try to explain it to yourself and talk to somebody else so you sort of quite clear in your own mind. Oh, this is what it's getting at. And of course, there are many different types of sutras. So there are sutras on emptiness, of course. So emptiness is a sort of a quality of that everything has. And so what was funny was he said, emptiness is a quality that all things, emptiness is telling you that all phenomena lack inherent existence, are without an objective existence. But emptiness, that's what's saying is, look, this object has no objective existence. It is empty of an objective existence. It does exist, but this doesn't have any objective existence. So you try to become familiar with this idea by reading and thinking about it. And over time, it'll make really good sense to you. And you go, of course, it's of course. One of the ways that really helps you to discover the emptiness of phenomena is to look for its opposite. Is it saying, look, the phenomena lack, that's what's empty of, something, a quality. What's the quality? You got objective existence, a natural existence, an existence that doesn't depend upon anything. That's what lacks. That's what's empty of. So then you start playing around with it, right? Go, is it true? So you just take any type of phenomenon, like a clock, you take something off and it's not new. In the old days, they did it on the chariot. You could do it on a car today. You can just look at the car, you analyze it to see, does it have an objective existence? Does it exist without depending upon anything? That's what inherent existence is, non-dependence. So you just look at this, like I said, grab the clock, look at a car. If this object depends upon anything, it does not independently exist. It does not inherently exist. That's what you understand. If it's dependent, it is not independent. If it is dependent, it is not intrinsic. It's not objective. It's not natural. It's not just there. So you do it, you know, analyze. You go, okay, sure, a car, of course, depends upon the wheels, the door, the main, all these parts. So it can't have any intrinsic existence. Doesn't objectively exist. What about me? Right, so now turn around on yourself. Here I am. What do I depend upon? Are you independent or dependent? You do the same analysis, right? But it's really quick, it'll come to you really quick if the car doesn't have it. You'll realize you don't either. You'll come around and who am I? What am I? Can I exist without any dependence whatsoever? If you see that's an impossibility, we've got the emptiness. That's it. You lack that way. And what you do is you just rest your mind in it. That's the absolute truth about you. You don't have this type of existence. And then the question will be, gee, how do I exist then? And you come out to dependence, dependently. I exist dependently. Because I do exist dependently, I do not exist independently, intrinsically, inherently, naturally, all those different terms the Buddhists use. Find one that resonates with you, that makes sense with you. Then you can go, it's true. Now I want to discover this. I've got it intellectually. Now I want to see it experientially. How do I do that? Now that's not too hard. It's just sitting down, going through. You just go through and you'll find the self you thought you had is not there. And you know it's true. I'm empty of intrinsic nature. I don't have that. So this is called meditating on emptiness. This is the great purifier. Everything. The people, once they understand this intellectually, like I've just been saying that with reasoning, you apply meditation. So the stuff I was talking about was like through reading, studying, thinking, right? You reflect on it. Once you get that sort of thing of like, oh my gosh, it's like now you want to make it deeper. That is the deepest truth about yourself, deepest truth about everything. And misunderstanding is the great cause of all of our difficulties. It's a bit like, sometimes in the morning, when I grew up in this town in New Zealand, it was freezing cold, right? Every morning you'd wake up to the kitchen, you couldn't see out the window, so they were frosted over. You couldn't, it's not on. And of course, you're in there and you're breathing, right? And it just goes up, and it's all really blurry, right? You cannot see the world. Well, the world is appearing to you like, geez, what? Like what? Like a big mess, isn't it? Not clearly. If you want to see it clearly, what would you do? That's right. Inside, you wipe the window down. We have to go outside with the hose and turn the hose on and wipe the bloody frost off so they can look outside. It's the same here. Right? We've just got this way of seeing things that presents it just like that, all frosted as a mess, as objectively, objectified, reified. That's what it looks like. Now we've got to get rid of that. So it will naturally look like that to you. I mean, it looks like that to you. It will always look like that to you for a long, long time until you're fully enlightened. But the belief that it is that way will vanish. Yeah, like when I looked out in the morning, right, at the frosty window, you can't see out there. I don't believe there's a world out there that looks like that frosty window, right? I don't believe that. I know it's frost. I just got to get outside, put the hose on, and wipe it down inside. It's the same here. For a long time, the world has appeared to ourselves in this rarefied manner. We ourselves have appeared rarefied to ourselves, as if we objectively exist. And we believe it, though. That's the thing, we believe it. Now we check. Are my beliefs true? And you'll find they are false. It does not mean you don't exist. It just means you had a wrong idea about things. That's what we need to abandon, the wrong idea. And then we start acting in harmony with the correct idea. I am a dependent, arising person. I exist in a world of dependence, where everything depends upon others. What's the best way to function and work in this world? The answer will come to you if you ask that question. This is what emptiness does. We realize that all phenomena, ourselves and everything else, are without this rarefied nature that they've seemed to have for so long. And of course, we do this on ourselves. If you do it on yourself and you find you're not there, then guess what? The karma's not there. The specific emotions are not there. They can't be there if you're not there, can they? Where are they existing? So you just do it on yourself. That's just a real quick and smart way. You could turn around on the delusions itself. You could do it on the mind, no matter what object it is. You've got to come up with the same understanding. This is why in the Heart Sutra they go, no form. They go, so there's nothing physical that exists in a rarefied fashion. There are no feelings. There are no discriminations. It goes through everything, doesn't it? Every little thing that Buddha can think of, they go, all of these phenomena are empty of the rarefied appearances they seem to have. They don't exist in that way. The rarefied view and your disturbing emotions. Yeah. So causes and effects don't inherently exist. In fact, there isn't anything that inherently exists. That's the simple thing. There's nothing that has any objective existence. So it's interesting, like what Sandy's saying. So this is what's so fun to do, right? So I've discovered this when I'm looking out the bathroom window. So I'm looking at the tree and the leaves on the tree. So if you know about cause and effect, right, you'll know that every cause, that there are different types of causes, and substantial causes turn into their effects. That's what a substantial cause does. Right? So now I look at the tree, I look at the leaves, and I ask myself, am I looking at a result or a cause? And what's the answer? Thank you. It depends. So now you know immediately that it's empty. of having any true reified existence as a cause or an effect. It's right down the middle. It depends. Everything depends. So you take any phenomenon that, that appears to you, you've got the sin, is it this or that? You go, it depends. That's the smart way. Come in, it depends, right down the middle. There's nobody really asking, is it this or that? This or that is reified. You might not know that, but it is. You're reifying it. You're separating it out from all the conditions and causes that produce it. And now it's just that. But it doesn't exist like that. So the right smart answer is always go, it depends. Now you've got freedom again. Now you can make all these choices. It's not this or that. It depends. You have a multitude of choices now. But like I said, you need to play with this. You know, philosophy doesn't need to be hard grind and, you know, and Buddhist philosophy has to be applied. It's not like applied science in a way, but you have to apply what you know. If you don't, it'll make no difference to your life. You must just go to school and learn about philosophy. It won't make a great difference to you. So here, we try these things out. Like the Buddha himself said, just don't believe me because I'm a Buddha, right? Don't believe me because everybody else has this great respect for me. He says, no, try it out. Only once you've had the experience yourself can you be sure. I think it's good advice to follow. There's a lot of freedom being in the classes too, right? You don't have to say, I have to believe Eddie because he's up there talking about the Buddha, right? Yeah, no, I'll check it out myself. And the more you do, the more confidence you have. You know, you can be certain, okay, this stuff works. In relationship to this meditating one empty, this is a quote here from Lama Rakesha, and he says, the realization of emptiness is inexpressible, unimaginable, unchanging, and a non-composite. And the yogi who realizes it destroys the obscuring delusions and the obscurations to knowledge. There's a lot being said in this quote, of course. So the obscuring delusions and obscurations to knowledge is what we're concerned with, right? They're the two problems we have. If you push in all the problems we have, we just fit into those two. Obscuring delusions and obscuring to knowledge. The yogi is a person, it could be a man or a woman, it's just the person who realizes this. Which they call yogis. They've yoked together the mind of enlightenment and the wisdom realizing this emptiness. Conceptually, they come together and they're yoked together. And you realize that when you have it, you know, but you can't express. You know, whenever you try to express, you go, that's not it. Like I said before, it's like trying to explain the taste of an apple, right? That's not it. Well, no matter what you say, it's not the taste of the apple. Right? So that way it's an expressive, meaning words can't articulate the realization of it. And, you know, we all know what an apple tastes like, isn't it? But the only way you know is by eating it. So in that way, emptiness is like that. No matter what I say or what the book is or that, it's just like pointing at it. The words are pointing at it. We have to experience it ourselves. If you imagine it, you know originally, no, that's not it, straight away, right? Imagining things is not the thing. And it is unchanging. This is why it's called an absolute truth. It never, ever changes from that. So I remember many years ago when I was, I've been trying to work out for years and years what was the truth. And every truth I came to changed. And I knew that can't be it then. That's not it. I think an ultimate truth, it can never change. If it changes, how can that be the truth? So all these changing truths are called conventional truths. And so we go, okay, what's all that from? What is there anything that does not change? We go, yes, this. But none of these conventional truths exist in the reified fashion they appear to. They're all empty of any intrinsic nature. And you go, why? Because they're dependent. Because they depend upon other things. So that never changes. That's the unchanging thing. It's lovely because you get the harmony of the two truths there, right? Ultimate truth and conventional truth. Well, I mean, I'm talking, I think this is all interesting. So in terms of the sutras, the easiest thing to take away, the simplest thing to take away from this is that reading wise words can change your mind. So it can change your mind immediately, but sometimes it takes years to go by before it finally drops. So Demi was just talking up there about experiences like that. I was like, yeah, that's right. Same with me. This is exactly what happens. You read them, you see them. It's important you do that because later on, you don't know when. Penny drops, as we say. And you go, ah, that's right. You know, I get it. I got it. I got it. After 20 years, I got it. Yeah, that's right. It's not instantaneous in many cases. Of course, you can hurry it up by meditating, by becoming familiar with it and testing it again and again. Yeah, that really hurries the process along. Another easy thing to take away from what we just talked about, like thinking differently can help you feel better. That's what interest is about, right? Nothing having an intrinsic nature, all depends. Change your thinking, you change your reality. Okay, so we move on to the next, the third one. So what have we got first? We've got reciting, reading sutras, and wisdom realizing emptiness. They're the two. They really work together. Yes.
Sorry. Wait,
yeah, there is a relationship with subtle impermanence, especially. It's subtle impermanence. There's a very strong correlation between those two. In fact, if you had direct insight into subtle emptiness, it would lead you very, very quickly, in a moment or two, to emptiness. Yeah, you would see that. Yeah, obviously. You just think about it very quickly. It's like, but again, see, the conventional truths lead you to the ultimate truth. That's the beauty of them. We need them. Without them, how are we going to realize the ultimate truth? We need the conventional truths. We examine the conventional truths. Asking, do these things have an ultimate existence? Are they ultimately true? You know, and then we find they're not, and that's the ultimate truth. Yeah, conventional truth is very important. In fact, Lama Tsongkhapa, what his genius was, to say straight up that they're both important, they're important as one another. And many of the other sisters, all they went up to the ultimate truth. Now, this is the big one, right? And he's going, how are you going to realize that without these ones? But these ones must be just as important as that. What's our next one? So reciting what they call purifying mantras. So the real meaning of mantra is that which protects the mind. So reciting words that keep the mind back from the disturbing emotions. And there are a number of them. So just recently we were introduced to the Vajrasattva deity practice, and in there they have a mantra. And we had to recite it a number of times to become familiar with it. And then of course we're also introduced to the meaning of each word. So it's the same. So Tara also has a wonderful, again, you can have a very long mantra, or you can have a short mantra. The Medicine Buddha is another one. That, if you come here on these special days and we do all of these practices, you'll be introduced to the mantra. So can anybody here is unsure about how a mantra can protect the mind? When you recite the mantra, right, you're meant to be focused on your recitation and the sound of it. You might also have the meaning back here, but probably not. So the major thing is to be reciting it and trying to feel into its reverberating power. So mantras can be recited aloud or silently. Often you'll see the teachers often say, do it verbally. So you actually say the sound aloud. Now when you say it aloud, you're meant to be listening to it. You say it, listening, the reverberations. So what this does, it keeps your mind away from the negative stuff of your mind. That's how it protects it. It's like you're separated off. Here's my problem. Yeah, okay, this is my problem. Okay, recite mantra. Now, why would you be thinking about your problem and reciting mantra? That's nuts. And it's not going to work. You know, what we do in the West normally is we go to the movies or we go and eat something, right? We take our mind off our problem and we put it on something else, like the food, like TV, like a show. That's how we protect the mind. We distract ourselves. It works for a little while. As soon as the food's gone down, you're back to your problem. And it's often the case with mantra. As soon as you stop, you have to be careful here, right? You don't just go back straight to your mental problem. You could, of course, but now you're not protected anymore. So you have to stop that. Now you go back to the mantra. But many of these mantras, you've got not only verbal recitation, then there's also visualization. So oftentimes what you're doing, you're about to suffer, you're going, oh, Vajrasattva Samaya, Manipaya. So there's Vajrasattva there in your mind, the nectar streaming down, coming all the way down through, washing away that problem. You're reciting those words. You cannot hold in your mind two phenomena that are so different, your problem and Vajrasattva imagery and the words. So in that way, you're protecting your mind. It depends. It depends, Ruby. It depends. So again, many of these practices are for the individual. So it's not like this is how you do it. It's what suits you. So you have many ways of doing it. Vajrasattva at the crown, Vajrasattva in front, Vajrasattva at the heart. You are Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva in yourself, union. All these different ways of doing it to keep your mind away from the disturbing emotions and what causes you suffering. But remember, you need a disturbing emotion to kick off the karmic seed. While your mind is doing this, it cannot be focused on a disturbing emotion. And so that's how you protect your mind. So thank you for saying that. Somebody, when I ask the scriptures, please, if you're not sure, just stick your hand up and go, hey, I don't know about that. Can you tell me some more or something? So these are quite traditional mantras, people can say. There's also the Confession of 35 Buddhas. So we have a trunk at the back of the hall with the 35 Buddhas. So when you do that, of course, how do you protect your mind from being negatively swayed? Well, this works, right? Remember, you're standing up there, you're reciting all the names and you're prostrating. Like you try doing that and holding the problem in your mind, I dare you. It's near impossible. You can't do it. So this is, one time I was studying and I got really stuck. But I never forgot it because my head felt like concrete. And I was like that story in the Buddhist text. This guy was so thick, the student, that they were given one line to remember, and the line would have four words. So by the time he got to the third word, the first two words were forgotten, and he got the fourth and not all everything before. That was happening to me up at CI, studying text. Oh, man, I was like, what's wrong with me? And I thought, I just have to try harder. But no matter how hard I tried, it didn't get better. Then Geshe said to me, you see, my light's still on the floor in the morning when I'm trying to memorize, go down, make tallies and go to sleep. Because you can have a breakdown like that, trying too hard. The thing is to stop doing it, and I found out doing the 35 Buddha practice. Man, that was amazing. The clarity after that. You sit down there, oh my gosh, big, big difference. So I'm trying to get here, even though I'm trying to explain things as best as I can, it's nothing like you doing it and finding that for yourself. It's like it's nothing like me having a big thing of apples and eating them and telling you how great apples are, but sorry, this is all you get. You get to look at them and watch you eat them. If you do it, you discover yourself. Right? If you eat the apple, you know.
And the beautiful thing with 35 Buddhas is the more you do them over time, you gradually get to know what each Buddha purifies as well, and it can slowly, little by little, you add depth and you And it's funny, if you get things that you've done in the past, and it's not until you kind of read about what that Buddha purifies you, I've never done that. And you really think about it, well, actually, I have, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, and so Mitch was just talking about initiations you do in Melbourne over the weekend and the 21 Taras. So the Tara practice is amazing too. So you've got 21, those are, each one of them purifies something individually. 35 Buddhas, they've made all these prayers, what they want to purify, the medicine Buddhas too. You say, like, this is what, this is how I want to help sentient beings. And then when they become enlightened, now they can. So they go, well, this, okay. I don't know whether it's true or not, but what have I got to lose by giving it a go? So there are some things that, you know, when you don't know, you don't do them. For me, one of the things I never used to do was prostrations, because I could not work out, like, what's the point? Like, how does this work? So nobody told me. So I thought, well, I'm not going to do it. Years go by, right? Did I work it? I go, oh, okay, now I can start doing them. So Geshe Tashi Seri, he pointed this idea out, you know, that this is what we do, this idea of, I don't know, so I'm not going to do it. He says, that's taking refuge in your ignorance. That was shocking. And I just went, oh my God, that's what I do. That's exactly what I do. I think because I don't know, I know something. I know I'm not going to do what I don't know. Yeah, so just to let you know that this can happen to you. And remember, the Buddhist stuff is all about non-harm. It's not harming yourself and harming others. It basically comes down to compassion. It's all based on compassion and wisdom. Compassion is supported by the wisdom. So I would say, like, you don't need to be too cautious here. There's, you know, sometimes when you don't know, that, I'll just give it a go. I don't know. You're right. I don't know. I don't know what apples taste like until I eat one. I don't know where these purification drugs work unless I do some. There's another practice you can do called relying on images. So these are the images, you can see them up there, right? But if you took this photo, I thought, wow, that's a great photo. So these are called satsas, and what you do is you paint them. You can make them and paint them. We've had other classes up here, painting classes, where all the people come and they paint the deities. It's a very different experience than just painting trees or koalas or something. Your mind is becoming familiar with what this deity looks like. The deity represents compassion and wisdom. They're all, every one of them is the union of compassion and wisdom, no matter what they look like. So you create these pieces of sacred art, and that's also after you find the mind. Well, you also have your body too, is how you're actually creating things. So do you have any questions about those two? There was, what was there? Creating sacred art and mantra purification. So you've got sutras, emptiness, mantra, art. So in terms of we've explained the mantra. The easiest thing to think about when you're, you know, wondering, like, how does this art business work in terms of purification? So when you, like, engage in creating something that's inspiring, like, it might even be just, like I said, painting a satsa, might be painting a deity or colouring it in or something, right? Do you remember doing that as a kid? Did you like it? I loved it. That's the point, right? To be inspired again, to invigorate the mind again, just to love doing it. That's virtue. Again, you're replacing negative stuff with virtue. Now, another way of purifying the mind is called relying on the names. So this means that you recite the names of the enlightened beings. So, you know, when we do the 21 Buddhas, we recite all the names. When we do the seven medicine Buddha practice, we recite all the names. 35 Buddha practice, you recite all the names. So those names actually often have a great deal of meaning in them. They're not like probably our names. But most names now we have don't have much meaning at all, do they? You go, so my name's Eddie. You go, what's that mean? what can you say? So these names are quite different. And actually, if you look at many of them, you break them down, and they're mostly written in Sanskrit, you find there's a huge meaning in each name. So just by reciting the names is a way of purifying the mind. Yeah, that's right. So the 21 Taras have a name each, and each Tara has said, you know, this is what she intended to do. And when she got enlightened, that's what she would do. So you call upon the names. You know, and in our culture, sometimes people go like, oh God, that's calling upon the God. Others, as we get very difficult, might call upon Jesus Christ or Mary. So we recite that name. We're inspired by what they've done and what they've said they can do for us. So we use the name. And same with him with the Buddhist name. And then there's often some little story about the glory of this Buddha and what they did. And Jesus, you know, that it has an impact on your consciousness. Yeah, it's a simple way to turn the mind towards the goodness. They're relied on worship. So here we have a big Buddha statue behind us. Most of these places will have them. And we have Tara and Lama Yeshe. And on this side, Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of this Stupa lineage. Over here is Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and Lama Zopa and so forth. So, yeah, we said to worship. But the focus is not on pleasing the external thing. And so you make offerings to images of Buddhas, stupas, you offer clothing, gold leaf, offer water. The idea here, again, is to go against the negative habits of the mind. We're just trying to find skillful means to go against what we normally do, and which normally produces suffering for ourselves. And when we make offerings or rely upon our worship, we're trying to cultivate a sense of generosity and humility. We're trying to create some positive energy in the mind. So this is a verse some of you might be familiar with. We often say it at the end of pujas, and while we do it, we're often throwing flowers up in the air. So when we used to do this at the old center, we actually got, we went out and bought all the flowers, we spent a couple of hours taking off each little petal, and then you go around and offer it to everybody. And then at the end, we would say this prayer, and you throw up all the flower petals. And you think of the flower petals as like an offering of my virtue. You've created some virtue, you do not want to cling to it as being objectively real, so you give it away. And it's through the giving that you receive the blessing. You have other flowers, this looks so beautiful. Oh man, gorgeous, all these soft petals, all wonderful, all these multicolors. You know? It's like, now you've got to clean it all up, take it outside, it's just gone. But it looked gorgeous while it was there. So, to sort of stop that, so Liffey bought all these plastic petals and flowers. We broke all those up, they look very nice too. And it's very easy, it's extremely light, we use it again and again and again. So, yeah, here's the verse, which is, I'll give you a little background to this verse. So this verse was written by Lama Tsongkhapa before he was called Lama Tsongkhapa. He was this amazing student. Everybody could see this guy is somebody special. So as a way of thanking his teacher for helping him become the person he was, he offered this praise to his teacher. And his teacher turned around and said, this praise is more suitable for you. And he gave it back to him. And the Tibetans have been saying it for the last 700 years, 600 years. Right? And now it's been passed on to us, and we'd say the same thing. So you can say here, it says, you, Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of non-referential compassion, and Manjushri, master of flawless wisdom, as well as Vajrapani, destroyer of hordes of demons, without exception. Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the sages of the land of snows, Losang Drakpa, at your feet I make prostrations. It's called the Mitsema Mantra. So in other words, this famous man called Lama Tsongkhapa, whose ordination name was Losun Drakpa. That was what he was called, but he became Lama Tsongkhapa. So what I found was really interesting was great treasure of non-referential compassion. So what is non-referential compassion? That the compassion doesn't objectively exist. It has no inherent existence. So there's no reference here to a compassion that has inherent existence. And it's empty compassion, dependently arisen compassion. That's how compassion exists, yeah, dependently. So there's no reference here, it's non-referential, meaning no reference to intrinsic nature. You are a person who's discovered that, so your compassion is empty of any reference. So his mind is this person called Lama Tsongkhapa. He said, look, you're Avalokiteshvara, you're Chen Rezig himself. Not only that, you're also Manjushri. And not only that, you're Vajrapani. So him have got compassion, wisdom, and power, all in one person. He says, to you, I pay homage. Yeah, that's right. All the aspects, all the things are enlightened being. That's who you are. Yes, purification and also accumulation of merit. So remember when Geshe Sofren was here, he loves this prayer. And so he wakes up, he's reciting it. He's dreams it and says it in his dreams. Yeah, this one. Huh? And so he says, oh, so something I've changed my mind on. That's right. Okay, we've got 12 minutes to go. So I think we can cover them. Let's do our first meditation. So please, readjust your posture so if you're quite comfortable in your seat. And just as your body has been doing since you've sat here, it's been breathing itself, right? You didn't need to breathe. The body did it for you. So just allow the body to breathe itself and just become aware of it. Just know breathing. And then bring to mind an altruistic intention. So perhaps this could be that we want to free ourselves from the weight of our past actions and their lingering effects to help others do the same. Now, the imprints of our past harmful actions, they are not permanent stains. They are temporary obscurations that we can cleanse. Without methods of purification, we remain caught in cycles of regret and repetitive patterns. And we feel stuck. The six methods I've introduced you to are like different medicines for the poison of negative karma. Each medicine works to counteract its harmful effect, the harmful effect of negative karma. So, how does knowing that purification is possible through many different methods? From study to simple acts of kindness. How can this change your view of past regret? How it can transform regret from being a heavy anchor into a simple signpost. It shows us where we can begin to apply a remedy. So what's the relationship between our inner thoughts and our outer actions? If our outer action were to create an offering or offer something beautiful, what's the relationship between that and our thinking? It shows that healing our inner world is not just a thought exercise. It can become real when expressed through our hands, through our voice, and through the heart. So I've shown you these six methods. Find one that's most accessible to you. You can use wisdom, you can use sound, or you can rely upon a simple act of generosity. Each method offers you a valid starting point. To remind you that the best medicine is the one you are willing to take. So sometime during the day, try to dedicate one simple, beautiful object as an offering to the best qualities within yourself and others. And breathing in, exhale, with your eyes open. Well, those are the six methods of sutra come through the Dhamma Ratisha. They're quite simple, and like I say, you don't need to do all six, you find one that works best for you. There are other methods of purification, and here we're going to look at Tantra and Sutra methods that are not those six. So the first is the Vajrasattva practice. So the very short mantras, Om Vajrasattva Hum. And if you say that 28 times during the, at someone possibly best at night, this is often a nighttime practice, you say Om Vajrasattva Hum 28 times, you stop any negative karma you've created during the day from expanding, from magnifying. Now, like Lama Zappa says, I mean, you know, again, you might not know how this works, and most of us probably won't, but I don't know how a jet fighter works, but you know, you don't get hop and run, it'll go, right? The Lama Zappa says, look, if you're not doing this, you're crazy. You are crazy. I really know that. I'm so crazy, I'm not going to do this too. There's a very simple medicine, Om Vajrasattva Hum, 28 times. The long one, Om Vajrasattva Samaya, Manipala, Manasattva, da 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 da, you say 21 times. And that's, you know, if you've taken the initiation, you can say that and count it towards your great accumulation. Most people find the short one the simple way to do it. This is, you won't forget, right? When you do the long one, boy, it took me a long time to memorize the long one. Boy, it's hard. But the lovely thing is that with it, you can sort of, when you say the long one, you've got enough time to just stay with that and do the visualizations. So Vajrasattva purifies the mind with light and the resolve. So in the Vajrasattva practice, you've got the four things there, the regret, the resolve, you know, the remedy. The remedy here is the light. The light is to remind yourself that nothing, the mind does not intrinsically exist. Negative karmas have no intrinsic reality. It all vanishes in the light. So the light comes down, washes you completely clean. In fact, you know, you become this light body. Now, after you've done it long enough, you get Vajrasattva to come down into you. And you know, you and I, Vajrasattva, we're one and the same thing. You relax in the natural purity that you've always had. Right? I just call this, it's just like coming home. You drop all the false ideas of who you are, relax into the light. The Vajrasattva is like purity, it's absolute purity. And this is the actual nature. We try to, you know, reacquaint ourselves with our original nature. There's many beautiful descriptions of Vajrasattva, man, about different. So he's made his different types of white light he's made up of and different parts of the garments and the skin and so forth. So you can go from sort of like a pearly type of white light until really bright. But of course, what happens oftentimes is you feel, after you do this, it's like you feel really invigorated. So it's a bit difficult to go to sleep after doing something like this, you know. It's a great one for doing in the shower. You know, if that water comes on, you hit, you go, there's the light, there's the, I feel the nectar and later Vajrasattva going. And you see him thinking of the shower head, you think, you know, there's Vajrasattva right there. There's all warm, cleaning me up. Say the mantras in the shower. And you see, you know, you're actually being clean, so just associate clean, unclean. Next one is 35 Buddha practices. I see we've got the tantra at the back there. So each time you make a vow, you're vowing, you're prostrating, and you're saying the names. You know, again, if you look at there's a practice that goes with it. Man, you read through that, you go, that's every mistake you could possibly make. Yeah, I've covered them all. So, wow. Okay, thank you. So it's a terrific practice. This way, you purify your mind through regret and the positive resolve. Okay? Just this different way of doing it. One is through the prostration and the name. The other one is through the light and the very short mantra. Like I said before, 35 Buddha practice, no initiation needed. It's a sutra practice. Just like medicine Buddha, it's a sutra practice. Anyone can do it. Vajrasattva, especially when you find the one where the, you have a... I can have a picture here. There's different pictures of Vajrasattva. Most times it's single, but sometimes it's a double. When you see it as a double, it's actually one thing, although it looks like two. But that one, often initiations are required. But again, just like I said, some of initiations sometimes not. So don't worry about that. Just go, I don't care. I just need to purify the mind. Yeah, that's the major thing. So our last meditation, and then two more slides that we'll call an evening. A morning, rather. So again, let's just settle down. Again, bring to mind an altruistic motivation. You want to free yourself from suffering as causes to help others do the same. So our practice is purifying negative karma, not through magic, but by actively transforming our relationship with our own actions through the four opposing powers. Without this inner work, the imprints of our past actions continue to shape the present. Our perceptions become clouded, our freedom is limited. So the Vajrasattva practice is like taking a shower for the mind. You wash away the accumulated grime of past negative actions. You leave yourself feeling fresh, clear, and clean. You can imagine Vajrasattva right now as a ball or a form of white light above the crown of your head. It's the embodiment of your own pure potential. So practicing this changes your relationship with past mistakes. Applying the Vajrasattva practice shifts the mind from guilt into an opportunity for wisdom and change. So why is sincere regret and not guilt the key to the cleansing? The sincere regret is a wise wish to be free from the cause of suffering. Guilt is a self-centered story that will keep you stuck in the past. So if you've had a challenge recently, this inner cleansing could offer a clearer path forward. The next time you have a shower, just think that this is the wisdom light of Vajrasattva, cleansing your inner and outer state of being. And please always acknowledge, you know, with these practices, you can always begin again. Okay, good. Just breathe again, exhale. And now just a few more slides here. So we've talked a lot about negative karmas and how to purify them, but not very much on the positive side. So I'll just say a couple of things about the positive side. The best way to make any type, to realize phenomena, to realize stuff, to make better for yourself, was given by Lama Tsongkhapa through the wisdom deity called Manjushri. He said, this is, Lama Tsongkhapa has been here for years, right? Couldn't get into this. Couldn't understand this. How am I going to do this? Luckily for him, he knew the shepherd who actually had direct communication with Manjushri. So he took him on the retreat, and then he asked the shepherd all his questions. The shepherd got in touch with Manjushri, got the answers and passed them on. Right? Then the shepherd says to Lama Tsongkhapa, yeah, you could do this. So he teaches him how to do it, and then he did it himself. The really amazing story when Manjushri first appears, right? He's looking down at his text, and the shadow falls across the text. Gives me goosebumps, thinking about, like, Jesus, there's something real. Like, I've conjured him up, and he's going to tell me. So he says, look, the best way to realize it, purify the mind, first of all. Get rid of the gunk. Right? Then accumulate merit. He did so one other thing, he said, always look at your teacher as being indivisible from the deity. Right? If you don't have a teacher, you can't do that at the moment, right? But you can purify karma and you can accumulate merit. This makes the mind ready for wisdom, ready for the wisdom realized in emptiness. Now the easiest way to create merit, right? Again, this came from a great teaching by the Buddha to a king. He said, I'm too busy to do all the stuff, right? I can't do it. But I do want to become enlightened. What should I do? Right? So he says, okay, you've done something foolish, regret it, do these practices, clean the mind up, but then rejoice. Rejoice. Like in what? So he goes, in your own virtue. You have the capacity to become a fully awakened being. Your basic nature is good. It's the complete opposite of a sinful nature. Your basic nature is clear, clean, like a crystal. Then think about your teacher's virtue. Think about what they're trying to do, the goodness that they're trying to impart to you, how they're trying to help you become the best human being you could ever be, in fact, greater than a human being, a fully awakened being. Somebody would actually take the time to help you do that. Rejoice in that. Someone cares enough about you. And lastly, ordinary beings. So I found it so simple. So simple, you know, I just walked down Newmarket Road to the centre and nobody's on the other side of the road shooting at me or throwing rocks. How wonderful. Because, you know, there's plenty of places all over the world where they're doing that. My God, thank you. Thank you, people. You know, there's a lot to say thank you for. So you keep doing that. That's a simple way of making yourself really happy, which you need to be. You can't engage in this path if you're a depressed person, right? You have to uplift yourself. Get, you know, ready. So the first thing is get rid of everything that hinders you and produce everything that supports you. And the simplest way for support is rejoicing. Yeah, and there was a time in my life when I used to rejoice because the sky was blue, because I could even see it. Because I knew there are many people in the world that cannot even see the sky. It's an easy thing to do when you think of all the things. The fact that you can walk, you're clothed, there's so many things you can be grateful for and go, wow, it's wonderful. This is all because of virtue. In fact, I remember one story saying that the man in the text had said that a slight breeze coming across your neck that makes you feel good is a result of your virtue. Yeah. Because you could get annoyed. There are people who don't like that, right? They say, well, it's not virtuous mind. But just the fact that we like it, That's the result of our virtue. So it's a simple way of creating more. So our takeaway today, we now have six ways to purify the mind, and there's those two deity practices as well. And also to gain quick realizations. I like to say, have a good meal, clean the plate first. Okay, so there are some notes and stuff that's up on the website. You can see it's FPMT notes, pages 49 to 53. Our own notes from pages 1 to 2, page 10, 41 to 47. And like next week is just a review of everything we've done already. I just say thank you very much for being here. It makes my life a happy one, a useful one. So I just say thank you again for doing that, and thank you for Geshe-la and his mother to help me come on this way. You know? So we have created merit to even be here, and we're creating more by being here. This is terrific. So you want this energy, this good energy, towards going towards the best result, enlightenment for ourselves, so we can understand the same. So please join me in saying these prayers. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. So we know this enlightened state depends upon a mind that wishes to do it, bodhicitta. May the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The two prayers, one for His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, by all your holy wishes, be spontaneously fulfilled.
Our batteries just died, hasn't it?
Okay, all right, that's okay. And finally, for our Rinpoche's recognition. In holding and spreading the Moon's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request.